In the middle of them rehearsing Big Bottom, Ron Jeremy walked into the room, looked around the room, and walked back out again. Turned out his band was rehearsing across the hall at this very same rehearsal complex.
Ron Jeremy had a band?
He did, yeah. He's actually a very talented piano player.
Huh.
I have a call from this gentleman in Hollywood, Columbia, and Peter Goober, and they want to fly you out there and talk about making a movie. It's like, what? Wait a second. I was in jail 4 months ago. I was eating beans for 5 years. They're flying me to Hollywood. I loved it, but it was so bizarre. That courtroom scene where I'm being resentenced, Oliver Stone has me screaming at the courtroom. You know, you're a nation of pigs. I fuck you all. I fuck your sons and I fuck your daughters. First off, the logic behind that. You've just been sentenced to life in this country. And publicly you say, I fuck you. I fuck your sons and I fuck your daughters. It makes no sense. That annoyed the shit out of me. I was a swimmer. I was an ocean lifeguard and shit. I was thinking about swimming it. But 17 miles after 5 years in jail, that's a really long ways. But these little dinghies, if I get one of those fuckers, I can get up.
I want to take you to an escape room.
You know, I've seen these.
I think we would win. Really, we would do great. Are you a better pianist than Ron Jeremy?
No, not even close.
Hey, this is Party Like a Rockstar podcast, and I'm your host, Joel. Today's episode is brought to you by Misha's Kind Foods. They're an LA-based small business making the world's finest non-dairy cheese on the market today. They're lactose-free, paleo, keto, kosher, perev, and 100% vegan. If you like what you see, check out the next video. If you like this video, please subscribe and like by clicking the little round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or our other guests on the show, go to joelrody.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle is Joel Rody. If you haven't already read my book, Memoir of a Rody, it's now available through Amazon and paperback Kindle or as an audiobook. I hope you enjoy the show. Billy Hayes is a writer, actor, and film director. He's best known as the author of the book, Midnight Express. Since that book was published, he's written Riding the Midnight Express, The Midnight Express Letters, and Midnight Return. He currently performs a one-man show about his life. He also recently wrote Midnight Express Epilogue, Train Keeps Rolling. I'm so out of it today. Train Keeps Rolling, sorry. A little background. The film Midnight Express was written by Oliver Stone. It won a ton of awards, including 2 Oscars. A bit of fun. After the initial success of the movie, Billy drove band equipment. He's worked for Heart, Avril Lavigne, Coldplay, Chris Isaak, Nickelback, Sum 41, Bare Naked Ladies, Train, and Good Charlotte. His buddy is Brian Anderson. He's a front of house engineer and a tour manager. He's worked for Kiss, Julio Iglesias, Blues Traveler, Hoobastank, Harry Shearer, and Natasha Bedingfield, and The Heavy. He's also the CEO of Brand Production Services. This poor fella has moved around more crap than any other roadie that I know. It was a horrible experience for me. I hope you like what you do. But my very first question is for Billy. Mm. And my question is, what is worse, living in a Turkish prison or having to move stuff around for Brian?
I actually loved moving stuff around. I love driving trucks. I love getting out on the road and just getting out of the cities into the desert under the stars at night and stuff. And as an actor and a writer, I'm waiting for the lawyer to respond. I'm waiting for someone to read my script. I'm waiting to get a part somewhere down the line, which makes you fucking crazy. Whereby driving the truck, I pick stuff up here. I drive it there. I dump it off. I get paid. I loved driving.
And you drove by yourself, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's interesting. So, you know, a bit of a tangent a little, you know, Buddy Holly wrote a lot of his songs on a 4-track. He would put it on the passenger seat and he would take a ride in the car all night and he would write, you know, those songs that we love. So did you get a lot of inspiration while writing or while George driving the truck then? Or
actually I did. I have in that new book, that Midnight Express Epilogue, I have a poem that I wrote to my wife that I picked up while I was out driving in the middle of the night, coming from somewhere in the Midwest and across the Texas plains and stuff. And there was a huge full moon setting in front of me and a sun rising behind me. So I wrote this haiku for Wendy that I put in the recent book. I get very creative out at night. What else are you going to do out there by yourself in the middle of the night in the desert?
Yeah. Do you listen to books on tape? Do you listen to CDs? What did you do?
I didn't actually. I think a lot. I'm always making notes, and I would find myself pulling over every half hour, 40 minutes, scribbling shit down in my pad. I don't do stuff into the phone very much. I'm very non-technical. I like to write things. I'm clinging to the digital age by my fingernails, and I hear them cracking every day. Brian, he knows all that stuff. He's real good at
it. You get it at all. And we heard Mac. Mac is better than PC. That's what I've taken from. All right. So yeah, I think you're the first truck driver I've brought on. So it's kind of cool. That's why I was asking some of that stuff. I always thought it was like romantic and thought, you know, driving across the country by yourself. And
it is. I loved it. It was good. The hard part was, of course, loading the truck. But I was, you know, much younger then. I'm 75 now. I can't do that shit anymore. But back then, I loved it. And it was a good workout. And Brian, he's got some kind of a thing in his head where he looks at the truck and he looks at the equipment, and he looks at the stuff, and he says, this one goes here and that one goes there. And the next thing you know, an hour has passed and the goddamn truck is full and we're loading, closing the doors. And that's when I'm happy. I'm not lifting and toting anymore. And I get in, I start the truck, and it's bye-bye world. And now I just have to get the stuff there on time, which I don't think I've ever missed a date. Did I ever miss anybody? No, not once.
No, you were always on time or early for everybody.
I'm very punctual. I'm disgustingly punctual. Yes, it's true.
You know, that's what made Spinal Tap so great, was their punctuality.
So, yeah, you did Harry Shearer, right?
Yeah. I've worked with Harry a bunch over the years. I actually did a little bit with Spinal Tap, a couple of local benefits, and I was scheduled to go on tour with them, but ended up having a debacle of a day at a studio in Hollywood, where in the middle of them rehearsing Big Bottom, Ron Jeremy walked into the room, looked around the room, and walked back out again. Turned out his band was rehearsing across the hall at this very same rehearsal complex. But anyway, yeah, just a lot of things he did. Yeah, he's actually a very talented piano player.
Huh.
Who knew, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't know. I know a lot of people know him real well. I actually know a guy who was his roommate.
Okay.
I didn't hear. I just heard like he ain't getting out of the clink is the rumor.
Probably not. But yeah, actually, he opened up for Blues Traveler at the Canyon out in Agoura one time as a pianist. He came out on stage and played a bunch of piano pieces, including Fur Elise and a couple other classical pieces. And it's like, okay, there's a side of Ron Jeremy you don't see every day.
Yeah,
interesting. That's Ron Jeremy, the porno star?
Yeah.
That's the guy.
Holy shit. Wow. Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So Spinal Tap, Harry Shearer, a lot of stuff with Harry Shearer and his wife, Judith Owen, who is an amazing singer, songwriter. It began with me working with her. I met her through her drummer and then met Harry through her and just went through many years of tour managing, doing sound and jumping around different places.
How did you get your go? You started as a sound guy, I'm assuming?
For me, it started as a musician. I was a drummer as a child. I started writing music on piano as a teenager. I started recording and performing with bands, you know, teens, early 20s.
Are you a better pianist than Ron Jeremy?
No, not even close.
Right, yeah. I bet you're a better singer. I've heard him sing. He can sing. I don't know if Ron can sing.
Yeah, we don't know if Ron can sing or not.
They used to do porn star karaoke. Do you remember that?
Oh, they did they?
Yeah.
I guess I missed out on that one.
Oh, really? It was a big thing here in LA. You've been in LA a long time?
I've been here since 99.
Yeah, they used to do porn star karaoke. It was good. Anyway, sorry, yeah. you're starting your career. Right.
All right, I forgot what we were talking about again.
So I asked if you started
as
a musician.
So yeah, so I became a keyboard player after I learned piano, which back in those days required several keyboards. So now that you have several keyboards, you need a mixing board. And so you use a mixing board to put all those keyboard sounds together. And naturally people see a mixing board and like, oh, you're a sound guy. So sure. I kind of became a de facto sound guy for friends and other bands in the neighborhood because I had a mixing board. So I learned how to work it. I learned how to do sound in live events and venues.
What was your first band called?
My first band?
Yeah.
The name of the band was The Name, and our song was called The Song. Wow. We rehearsed at a place. Wow.
It's good.
It was pretty bad.
That's good.
But yeah, I went through several incarnations, you know, and realized that I could actually make a lot more money as a sound guy than as a musician. And so I kind of parlayed what I had learned, you know, of doing sound for other bands into like, let's do this as a profession. And I've managed to work with some of the biggest artists in the industry. So.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. And so, Billy, you get back to the United States, and I'm imagining you're trying to figure out what's next in life. And you ran into Brian?
No, actually, I met Brian. I got home. I escaped in 75, and then the movie came out in 78. And then I was doing a lot of other stuff. And somewhere, Brian, I think I met you at Don Chastain's funeral. Isn't that where we first met?
Very first meeting, yes, but we actually spoke at Vicky's Christmas party,
and you said something
and
about
where I told you about what I do with the driving gear. You're like, I would love to do that.
well, I think what I told you is I think you said, can you drive a truck? And I said, sure. And then next thing I know, we were sort of driving together on our first thing around LA a little bit. I think you wanted to see, can I really drive? And then I was suddenly heading up towards like Seattle or somewhere in a truck.
You drove Gear for Heart from LA to Seattle. Yeah. Was the first big one. Yeah.
Did you know did you know the Midnight Express story and stuff, Brian? Or you
knew absolutely. I mean, yeah. I knew that, you know, from the 70s. I saw the movie and, you know, was as moved as everybody was from, you know, how powerful it was and the music, which was amazing, and won Giorgio Moroder an Oscar.
Giorgio, right.
And so, yeah, so as a music
you also,
guy.
You also went out with my former manager. So
right.
We knew each other from there, yeah.
Exactly.
What was, I've been trying to think of like questions to ask you that you don't get stuck answering all the time, Billy. And I might have a few, I don't know. But
Please, one
I thought might be fun. What was the first meal you remember eating when you came back from Turkey?
Actually, the first meal I remember that I...
Us roadies love food.
I put it down in the book. In Amsterdam, my first time really being free, you know, I escaped from Turkey and I was running through Turkey and I was in Greece and then I got out of Greece and they put me in a plane and I landed in Amsterdam and I spent my first 4 days of freedom in Amsterdam. But they dropped me off and I wandered around and I heard what's it? Midnight Rider?
Oh, the Allman
Brothers, isn't it?
It was one of them. There was some funky music coming out of a little hotel in Amsterdam. And Mustang Sally, that's what it was. Mustang Sally. So I went in the hotel and I checked into the hotel. And downstairs, they had this little coffee shoppy place. And it was Amsterdam. And I ordered peach pancakes and a strawberry ice cream soda. And that was my... That was my first real meal in freedom. And it was so unbelievably good, I told the waitress, do it again. So that was my first meal in freedom.
That's neat. So how long were you in Amsterdam? So you flew from Amsterdam to the States?
To New York, where I got off the plane at Kennedy Airport, and there were 100 reporters in the airport asking me questions. You know, Billy, what's it like to be home? I don't know. I just got here. I haven't even seen my mom. And that never stopped. I'm still 50 years later, I'm still answering questions and talking about this Midnight Express stuff, which is pretty bizarre for me. I mean, it's good for me. Obviously, it's therapeutic. I started talking about it the moment I got free, and I've never stopped, which I think is good. You know, a lot of guys, most guys who come out of prison, they don't talk about it a whole lot. They kind of keep it in, which I don't know. I don't know if that's good for you. It certainly wouldn't have been good for me. The fact that I got home on a Friday, by Monday, I was writing my first book about it. I'd be still procrastinating about writing this book. I didn't want to think about jail. I wanted to forget fucking prison. I wanted to get that life. But I had to write it because I was forced to economically and such. And I realized emotionally, I was a writer. I went to Marquette University. I was in the journalism school. I went out into the world to experience life like my hero, Jack London. And I wanted to get my books published. Surprise, surprise. Yeah. I eventually got them published, not quite the way I wanted. But by Monday, I was writing this book. And that was so good for me. Therapeutically, getting it out and having the words stick to
the
page.
So did you start writing immediately because you didn't want to forget certain stuff? Or was it because...
No, it was because I had endless notebooks that I'm always writing. I'm always scribbling things. I had thousands of letters, literally, that I wrote. I was in jail, like, you know, 5 years. I wrote home every day. People kept my letters and they gave them back to me after I escaped and got home. And, you know, I'm going to write a book. And they all mailed me the letters. So I got to read, put them in order and read all these letters that I'd written over a 5 year period, which was an amazing source of material to write the book about. But I didn't want to do that. I'd be saying, you know, I'm going to start it next week, next month. I got to go on vacation. I don't want to be thinking about prison all the time. But when I got home on a Friday, as I mentioned, there was a press conference. By Monday, I was meeting literary agents. I had one. Suddenly, I've got E.P. Dutton, is a big publisher back then, giving me in advance and wanting me to write this book. And it's a now story. I mean, we're in the news. And they actually had a clause in the contract that said, if you can deliver us a completed manuscript, I think it was in like 4 months, which was an incredibly short period of time, I would get a better deal on the paperback deal, which came later. Oh. I don't think they ever expected me to get it done. But I was working with this writer, Bill Hoffer, who my agent said, we need somebody to organize you. In fact, I knocked out 15 pages that I gave to my agent. And he read it. He said, well, Billy, this is very good because now we know we need a professional writer to work with you. I said, no, I don't need it. I so needed someone to help me organize. 5 years of stuff. I'm not seeing the forest for the trees. And I met a bunch of big name writers, Peter Moss, and a bunch of people who, all of whom I thought were douches. And I met this guy, Bill Hopper, who I really quite liked, who he kind of reminded me of my wife. This was earlier that I met, but very similar in terms of very steady, very calm, and never gave up, kept pushing me, kept forcing me to write. I wanted to quit. I wanted to forget it, but I needed to get it out. And as it started to come out, it became much easier. And after 4 months, we had a finished manuscript. And then things got really weird.
So how many pages was your book? The first, Midnight Express. How long
is it? The first book, I don't know, where is it? 300 or something? I got to look around.
So yeah, that's a heck of a lot of pages in 4 months.
Yeah, in 4 months. Oh no, we wrote every day, nonstop. The Busy Bee Book Factory. He lived in Maryland with his wife and his kid and stuff. And I was in New York and I would write a bunch of pages and then send it off to him or he'd come up on the train and we went back and forth. And he kept forcing me to, like he'd read some stuff that I wrote. First thing we did was take all of these letters and he read them all. I read them all. We transcribed them. He sat me down in a room with a microphone and had me talk for 3 days nonstop. And as you see, I can talk. And that's all we did. And then we had all of these tapes transcribed and then had them down on paper. And it's a humbling experience to read how you speak. You, third person, me, how I speak nonstop and non sequitur. But it gave us the beginnings and the way to organize this thing, which is what I need. I needed an organization. And Bill did that. So we knew the book starts here. The book ends there. All I got to do is fill in the middle. And that's what we did nonstop for the next 4 months.
My one that was funny was the word just. I used the word just so much when I was writing. And then I realized if you get rid of the word just, every single time it's a better sentence. Every time, like every time. Yet you keep writing just knowing you're going to have to delete just. You still do it.
It's a little bit of an edge. Just gives you a little bit of an edge over what you're saying.
Yeah, but sometimes when you take it out, then you're like, oh, that has more impact.
Yeah.
Just. Terrible word, this just word.
Anyway.
And however is a winner. A lot of howevers. So did they give you an advance?
Yes. The first money I got when I came home was the book money advance, even before I'd gotten involved with the film, which was great because I came out, I owed everybody in the world and I had no money. And, you know, what kind of work am I going to do? Job description, previous employment, the last 5 years, convict, doesn't get you a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I hit the ground running. And so the advance filled in very nicely. And before the book was even finished, early galley of the book somehow was seen by a producer at Columbia named Peter Guber, who has since gone on to become a mega producer. And he loved it. And he contacted my agent, Julian Bach. Julian, one day the phone rang, he said, Billy, I have a call from this. He's a very erudite kind of guy. I love Julian Bach. He said, I have a call from this gentleman in Hollywood, Columbia and Peter Goober, and they want to fly you out there and talk about making a movie. It's like, what? Wait a second. I was in jail 4 months ago. I was eating beans for 5 years. They're flying me to Hollywood. I loved it, but it was so bizarre, so strange.
Sure.
And yeah, it started the beginning of this whole, the book was one process. And then when it became a movie, it became this other bigger process. And the movie kind of kept going until suddenly in 1978, it premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, which is a bizarre thing to do with a brand new film. And they took a big chance in doing it. But it...
You went to the premiere?
I went to the premiere. I was there with Brad Davis, and both of us were like totally squacked out of our minds, smoking a lot of pot. He loved to snort coke and stuff. Coke is not my drug. I wake up in fifth gear. I like to smoke pot. I don't drink alcohol. I don't smoke cigarettes. I do yoga every day for 50 years. But being at the Cannes Film Festival was so bizarre.
Was that your first time flying back out of the country?
Yes, actually. I don't think I flew out. Maybe. Did I travel? I might have traveled a little bit somewhere else. I was okay. The Turkish government didn't issue an Interpol warrant for my arrest. I escaped, but they didn't issue an Interpol warrant when I escaped or when my first book, Midnight Express, came out in 1976, whenever that was, early on. But when the movie came out, and they saw the scene in the film, specifically the courtroom scene where my character, Billy Hayes, was being resentenced. I was supposed to go free in 54 days. You know, I had a calendar. I was crossing out 54 days prior to going free. The American consul shows up for an unexpected visit and tells me that the Turkish High Court in Ankara has rejected. Richard Nixon was pressuring all of these countries that we aided, which was everybody in the world. But it was the start of the war on drugs, to pressure and increase their drug penalties. And the Turks said, fine, you want to see what we'll do? And what they did was they sentenced people like me, idiots like me, who are caught having instead of going free in 54 days, I was suddenly looking at life in prison. A couple of other Americans, two women and a guy, 2 months later, got the same thing. This was showing that the world, that Turkey was increasing their drug penalties. And that courtroom scene where I'm being resentenced, Oliver Stone has me screaming at the courtroom, you know, you're a nation of pigs. I fuck you all. I fuck your sons and I fuck your daughters. First off, the logic behind that. You've just been sentenced to life in this country. And publicly you say, I fuck you. I fuck your sons and I fuck your daughters. It makes no sense. That annoyed the shit out of me. And then.
That's what Brian says when they want to give him another truck of crap to move.
No more trucks.
It's not part of the deal.
What I really said to them was, if you're going to send me more prison, I can't agree with you. All I can do is forgive you. Forgive you? Fuck your sons and daughters? A big difference. The whole world heard, fuck your sons and daughters. They saw me kill a guard, which I didn't do. I escaped off an island in a rowboat in the storm, made for Hollywood. They didn't even do it. They just had me skip out the door and then, first off, kill a guard, which I didn't do. This is all Oliver's fantasies.
How does he get into the mix, Oliver Stone?
Peter Goober saw the script and read it. And then he met Alan Parker in somewhere in LA who was getting on a plane and he gave it to him and Alan Parker loved the script. And then they read a script that Oliver Stone wrote that he couldn't get made into a movie that he was so frustrated about called Platoon.
So who wrote the script? You wrote the initial script?
No, Oliver Stone did. I wrote the book. Oliver Stone wrote the script because they loved what he did with Platoon. And they said, this guy who can write Platoon can probably write a prison movie. And they put me and Oliver in a hotel room at the Mayfair Hotel in Manhattan for about a week. And, you know, he was crazy. I loved him because I loved the crazy energy he had then. But, you know, he's smoking joints and drinking Bloody Marys and snorting lines and just a madman. And I loved it. And we talked nonstop for a week. And then as I was leaving, I said, so what happens now? He said, now I go to a little cabin in the mountain with my little mound of coke and I'll write this script. And he said, then it's like having a child and sending it off into the world because you give it to the studio, that's it. You don't know what they're going to do with it. And I actually signed a contract when my agent said they want to make a movie. They flew me to Hollywood. That was all good. And then we got an offer from them, which was more money than I could even imagine, like $60,000 at the time. Which for me, I mean, God damn, that was so good. That's the advance on what it was. I think it was actually 120 total advance on the movie at the time, which again, I think I could live forever on that money. That shows you where war back then. But, you know, it was okay and I loved it. And next thing I know, they're making a movie and they're casting people. And that was a bizarre experience to see the movie up there on the screen at Cannes and have the audience when the movie finished, the audience was dead silent. And Peter Guber, I heard him talking in this documentary they did. He said, I was sitting there with Alan Parker and the movie ended and the audience was silent. They didn't make a sound. And we thought, oh my God, they hated it. We're dead. And he said, then the lights started to rise and the audience stood up and they were screaming and cheering. I'm kind of like down under the seats. I'm sweating to death. I've just been looking at my life up there on the screen in front of me. And it's playing in the screen in the back of my mind at the same time.
Was that the first time you had seen the film too then?
It's the first time I saw it in a theater with an audience. I saw one copy of it, one showing of it by myself this is a couple of months earlier in Manhattan in the little studio that Columbia has somewhere on Fifth Avenue or somewhere, in a little tiny screening room. It was just me. They sat me down. Nobody was there. Suddenly the lights go and Midnight Express, the movie comes up. And I'm like, holy shit. It blew me away because it's a brilliant film. I mean,
did they have Giorgio's music was already in it and stuff?
It was almost a finished cut. Every once in a while there'd be a little splice somewhere, but it was done. It was finished, and emotionally it was so impacting. And the music was there, and it, you know, there were things in it that just broke my heart. There was other stuff that annoyed the shit out of me, like the whole courtroom scene, as I mentioned. The thing I was most surprised about is when all this happened, I knew no matter what they did, they would put in this made for Hollywood. I escaped off an island or a rowboat in a storm and ran through Turkey. Made for Hollywood. In fact, I was worried people are going to say, great film, except for that made up ending that Billy put in. They didn't even do it. They had me kill a guard again that I didn't do and then skip out the door. It's like, if it was that easy, I wouldn't have waited 5 years. I love seeing Brad jump in the air and kick his heels in the air and they freeze it on that. It's a lovely ending, but yeah. I'm the lead objective of viewers. And like, that's not how I escaped. I literally, prison says 24 hours a day, prison says you're a loser, you're a loser, you're a loser. And eventually that seeps in and you buy it and you are. It breaks you in ways you can't fix it after a while. I was kind of like getting to that point and I was getting desperate. And then I got really lucky and I got myself in. I was stupid enough to get busted and put my family and everybody who loved me in prison at the same time, which was, even now 50 years later, that's even hard to say. If you back your car out of the driveway and your mom's there and you break her leg, oh my God, that's terrible. But you take it to the hospital, you get a cast, and day by day, it gets better. Yeah. It never got better for us. My mom cried herself to sleep every night, and we didn't know when I was coming home. And then when we had a date and I was crossing off the calendar, she's where I am. She's thinking she's going to see me in 54 days. And now I'm looking at life in prison. That kind of pain to cause my family, it was bad enough prison for me, but what I did to them, that was really the hard part. And I got myself out. That's my point. It's like I escaped off the goddamn island. I got myself out and rowing away, having my life in my own hands again, having control of my life.
Boat? Someone gave you some money?
Oh, how much time do you have? No, on the island, this is all in, the escape is in the last two books, in Midnight Return, actually, I put most of all of the escape in there. But I got to this prison island, and they have these boats that go about 26 kilometers, so 17 miles from the coast. It's a prison island, it's a work island. We have a factory there, and they bring produce and stuff comes over in these little boats from the mainland. And then we carry it up the hill to the factory, cheap labor. And we can all this shit from the mainland. But these little boats that come over from the mainland, they all have little dinghies tied behind them. But they're never allowed to spend the night in the harbor because it's a prison island. Until, as I noticed one day, a big storm was whipping up at sea and the waves were whipping in and these boats were anchoring from the night. And I looked down and I'm thinking, these little dinghies, these little rowboats, I mean, I was a swimmer. I was an ocean lifeguard and shit. I was thinking about swimming it. But 17 miles after 5 years in jail, that's a really long ways. But these little dinghies, if I get one of those fuckers, I can get out. That was the problem getting away from jail, is getting The first prison I was in had the barbed wire and stuff. This was an open island. They considered the sea to be the wall around. We went out, worked around the island, carrying shit up and down from the docks to the canning factory. It was lovely. If it wasn't jail, it would have been a real nice place to be. But I could get down by the water, and I knew if I can get out to one of those little boats, row to the mainland, I'll make my way back through Turkey. One way or the other, I will be free, either free or dead. I'm just not going to be in prison anymore. And I got really lucky. I mean, there were a bunch of times, if things went this way as opposed to that way, I wouldn't be talking to you now. But I'm a lucky guy, so what can I say?
Would they let you out of jail, you think, ever?
Well, yeah, eventually I probably would have, somewhere down the line. There was talks about amnesty at one point. They took my life sentence, the same judge who originally sentenced me to 4 years and 2 months in jail. He was forced by the high court in Ankara, because of Nixon and the pressure, to change my sentence and to sentence me to muhabbet, which is life. The only prerogative he had, he could lower the life sentence to 30 years, which he did. You know, life, 30 years. Thanks, I guess. Yeah. But the judge felt bad. Actually, I read stuff in the Turkish newspapers afterwards. The judge at one point dismissed this thing, and he had somebody else pronounce the final sentence. He said, I can't do this. I wish I had retired before I was forced to issue this sentence. I mean, Wow, that's my judge. But, you know, you think about it now, cannabis now is legal. People realize how healing a product this is. This plant growing from the ground that for 5,000 years mankind has been using, and it's only the last 50, 60, 70 years, this idiotic war on drugs, where they've done all this, putting all these people in prison for cannabis. So I got life in prison for cannabis, and it's now legal, and I'm selling and I'm working with cannabis companies. I was entered in this year's World Series of Poker by Hemp Inc., a cannabis company. I mean, you know, you can't make that shit up.
Did you ever meet Howard Marks?
No, I know who he is in terms of the world of cannabis. Yeah.
Okay. His book is just so good. It's amazing. So he passed away now, but.
Yeah.
Is the character Rifki a person or is it a conglomerate?
I have to think back between the first book. I changed all the names in the first book. I believe the real guy, Rifki, I believe his name was Ziyat. And he was a Jordanian guy who, he was like amoral. He didn't care about anybody or anything but himself. And he was sort of the drug dealer and stuff. I've changed names. I had Rifki, and I think I actually made him as Amin, the guy I got in a fight with the first night, which actually turned out to be a lucky thing for me to get in a fight the first night. Because it sort of gave me a little cred in the prison, because this guy walked around with a black eye for like 2 weeks and they wanted to know, you know, what happened. And he said, the new guy, Willie, which is my name in jail. And, you know, the look in Rifkin, his black eye is swollen a bit. And then they look at me, I weigh 150 pounds. But they think, you know what, if they're looking for somebody to mess with, let's find somebody else. So it kind of held me in good stead. You know, I got my hands and my feet beaten after the fight, which that's how they, it's a form of punishment called falaka. If you and I got in the fight and the guards came in and I was all bloody, they would beat you bloody equally. You were all bloody, they'd beat me bloody equally. It's like, you can't win. You got to get in and get out, not have the guards find it. But because he walked around prison with a black eye, people sort of gave me a little prison respect, which was nice. Because I'm 150 pounds and I got blonde hair and blue eyes, which was good on the outside, but not always so good on the inside. Mm. So it was good to be in a fight the first night. Strangely enough. And the beating on my hands and feet made me realize I don't ever want to get beaten again. So let's not do anything that's going to get me where the guards tie you up and beat your feet with a stick. That's not good. In fact, I jokingly say these days, people ask how I'm doing. I'm healthy. I'm free. My wife still loves me and nobody's beaten me with a stick. Everything else is gravy. Sometimes it's hot gravy. Sometimes it's cold gravy, but it's gravy.
In the film, they break through the wall. And what's his name? The great actor who's kind of nutty now.
Randy Quaid.
Thank you.
Well, Randy went off the edge, way off.
Nutty.
That whole thing, that escape thing, that was a short story I wrote, or one of my early many things that I wrote in jail that Oliver Stone heard me talk about. And he loved the idea of breaking out. You know, the whole prison, the whole city, is built, it's 1,000-year-old, 2,000 years old. The Romans had all these catacombs and things down below it, and aqueducts. So the idea of getting down below there in this little dumbwaiter thing and breaking through and getting out through the caverns literally was something, you know, I plotted and planned prison escapes constantly. I knew back roads. I knew routes out. I knew where the river had shifted between Greece and Turkey. There was a river coming down from Bulgaria, and sometimes the river would shift. So which was Greece and which was Turkey kind of thing, moving back and forth, because I knew all the stuff, all the plots and plans. That's all you did in jail. That's all I did, was plot about getting out.
But you guys didn't really try and do that? It was
no. No, I got it because there was a, from the top of the cell block down below, there was a big, like a dumbwaiter, like a thing that you could pull on a rope. And when the prison was younger and they had it, they used to send stuff, food and bread up and down these corridor things. But then they broke and they let it go. So after that, people would come around with these big blankets full of loaves of bread, and, you know, stuff them through the hole in the door.
But so you did. You guys did get down there, and it was a dead end. There was nothing there.
Oh, I got down there, but there was nowhere to go. It was the kitchens. And first off, you have to get down there at a time where nobody's there, which... And then where do you go? There was no there down below. There was a cavern back from the Romans from 1,000 years ago. And I could break through. I could hear the water in the wall. So if I break through, maybe I could, you know, that's.
I'd like to think that you stayed in touch with Randy Quaid for all these years. He's got to be fun.
I did for a while. Randy and I were friends. Randy, Brad, myself, John Hurt. I mean, he was an amazing character.
So good.
Yeah, incredible actor. Poor Randy. I mean. I think Randy kind of went off the deep end, and he was married to a lady. I think they had, what's it, folie à deux? They kind of like egged each other on to conspiracy type of ideas, even before all of the idiot stuff that's going on now. But, and it led him to such a strange place, and I feel bad for him. I mean, he was a brilliant actor, and
yeah.
A nice guy and a funny guy, and he just sort of went over the edge. I was reading where he was saying, you know, that Hollywood, there's people who are now stealing the residuals of Hollywood actors and blah, blah, blah. And I've thought a little about the logic. If you're going to go through and steal someone's residuals, at least steal somebody who's working now steady and making a lot of money. No offense to Randy, but I don't think he's making a lot of money these days.
Yeah, yeah.
I get money from residuals too, not like him, but you still don't make much. And, you know, it's been a long time. So I think they, you know, you get Tom Cruise's residuals. That's nice. So I feel he went off the deep end somewhere.
There's a fun one. So Brian, so I remember, like, if we're going to go into Canada and you got a couple misfits on the crew, you alert ahead. Hey, we got a couple guys, we got a DUI here. They care a lot about DUIs, I remember. And so, you let them know when you get to the border, who's coming, right? And then it's easier to get into the country. So what would you tell him for Billy driving? There's a whole movie about this guy.
Yeah, well, any tour that I've gone into Canada, we've basically dropped off anybody that had an existing DUI in the record at the border. Dropped him off, and like, you guys are staying here until we come back to this side. You know, Billy, I did send Billy into Canada a couple times, didn't I, into Vancouver?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't have too many problems.
No, at that point, it was so far past, you know, everything that had happened. There was no Interpol warrant anymore anywhere. So,
right. Yeah, that dropped. I had that for 20 years.
Yeah, and a lot of these guards are younger. They don't even know the story, you know, so.
You flew me to Canada one time, and then you and I drove a truck through a blinding fucking rainstorm all the way across Canada down to Milwaukee, and I think we had some deadline. But we had to make it, so we didn't even stop somewhere to sleep. You drove, I drove, you drove.
And that's correct.
Pouring rain the whole time.
We had 36 hours to make it from, we were either in Edmonton or Calgary. I can't remember, whichever one's farther north. And I drove straight through. And then in northern Minnesota, the roads were flooded. Remember, the water was up to the doors of the truck as we were driving through. Yeah, so I would drive a few hours, Billy be sleeping in the passenger seat and vice versa. And we made it. We made it there, and actually with time to spare. And that was for DJ Shadow. Remember? Yeah. DJ Shadow, an artist out of San Francisco, who does this amazing visual experience with his DJ thing. Check it out sometime.
Oh, well, okay. So one of the questions I like to ask, so my friends have children. My friend's daughter was in elementary school when I first started this. I think she just started seventh grade. So our question was, when did you first feel famous? And so I ask each of you, when did you first feel famous? If fame is not an answer you want to pursue, when was there a moment in your careers or in your lives that really changed things? It was a big impact. What would each of you guys choose as your moment?
BA, what are you going to say?
There's no moment for me. It's been a gradual process over many, many years from back, you know, being a sound guy in Chicago and working with some somewhat bigger artists, and then, you know, and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger. And I mean, I do remember when I got the job working for KISS, I thought that was a pretty huge step. I came in as a road manager, which basically meant that I flew in the private jet with them and Doc McGee and went straight to their dressing room. And
tough work, but somebody's got to do it, Brian.
Yeah.
But I mean, literally, I just come off a previous tour with one of Doc's baby bands where we were traveling in a van and we're like doubling up rooms at Motel 6. And now suddenly I'm in a private jet with KISS, you know. So, but I've worked with a lot of A-list, you know, artists, celebrities, rock stars, however you want to put it. And, it's been a gradual thing overall. So I can't say there's a moment, but, you know, I don't feel famous myself. I just happen to work around famous people.
Okay. What do you got, Billy?
Well, I don't know if famous is the word. I think infamous might be more correct for me at this age.
Maybe.
You know, when I was in prison, I was isolated for 5 years. And I would get letters and I would write letters. And every once in a while, Newsday would do a story on me. You know, a local boy goes bad and that kind of stuff. But I was so isolated. And then, as I mentioned, I stepped off the plane at Kennedy into 100 reporters. So suddenly the moment exploded. By the time I got home to New York, I was on, my sister was saying, quick, come on, you're on TV. On all the stations, you know, that have two or three stations back then. There I was at Kennedy smiling and stuff and sitting with my arm around my dad and having this press conference going on. And it was such a bizarre reentry into life. And it kind of set the tone. I used to dream about getting free. And one of my fantasies was like going to Morocco, to some little quiet beach and just, you know, living quiet and having this nice lady with me who liked to eat some fruit and swim naked in the ocean. That was my vision. When I escaped that little beach in Morocco, actually, they were having a civil war and that whole beach was mined and they were fighting with tanks on that. So again, expectations leading astray. And my expectations coming home were quite different than what they actually became.
Sure.
And it just kind of kept building and building. I think the Cannes Film Festival, in terms of one event that was, it splattered me and Brad Davis, the actor, just splattered us across the globe. Because it was a huge hit in every newspaper, everywhere in the world had pictures of us on it. And we were doing interviews and like, that was weird. It was wonderful in a way, but it was so weird. Except for me at Cannes, afterwards at the big festival, I was in the middle of the crowd and Rhona Barrett was doing the thing, you know, the old gossip columnist lady, and people were around screaming. And out of the crowd, this beautiful blonde haired, blue eyed angel kind of approached me and put out her hand and asked me to dance. And I did. And that was my wife, Wendy, who I've been married to for 42 years.
Oh, so, cool.
Yeah, you know, that was a huge moment for me. That's Cannes was pretty substantial in terms of turning my life.
So how long did you stay in touch with Brad Davis regularly after the film?
Pretty much all the time. Brad and I we had such a unique connection. We were good friends. Again, you never know with him. He was childlike, which is how he became such a wonderful actor, and he was childish in terms of his habits and how he would hurt people in ways that he didn't mean to, but it hurt him and hurt his friends and hurt them. I wouldn't see him for months and suddenly he'd show up out of the blue and he's wild-eyed. He's got this energy pouring off him and he's like, quick, get it now. And I'd have to jump in his Jeep and off we'd go on some adventure somewhere. When there was fire in the hills one time, he wanted to get close to the fire So he came to pick me up, and we drove past fire lines. He had the Jeep. He had it in four-wheel drive. He was to get into the fire. It's like, where the fuck are we going? He said, we got to get close to it. Said, that's it's an event. You got to be part of this thing. Like, he was so crazy and so wonderful at the same time. He was, I love Brad, and I feel so bad that his light burned out so way, way, way too soon. Way too soon.
I just kept thinking James Dean. I don't know. He had the walk about him. I don't know. There was something.
He also had that charisma about him, and he would have done so much better if he stayed alive. And he would, and his talent as an actor would blossom and mature in ways. I don't think we ever really saw everything that Brad could do, and then it was too late, and he was gone.
Yeah.
And I miss him.
Oh, he did so good in your film, man. It was so ridiculously good. But a lot of it's because of him. And then he wasn't nominated. It was nominated for all this stuff, and he wasn't.
Yeah, I know. It was hard. He got nominated for a Golden Globe, which was good. And we got to go to the Golden Globes. And that was
Who won Best Actor that year for Oscar?
Who did?
I can cheat, but...
Some schlub. Who knows who he was?
Some guy. Some random guy. So here's one of my one is... What are some of the crazier gigs that you've worked? Some of the fun stories, you know, Nutty Loden's, crazy venues, you know.
I know Brian's got a bunch. My craziest and the one I like the most is somewhere Brian got me driving a van around the Southwest following Ice Cube and the West Side Connection. And I had a van that had, so I think it was like a bunch of special lighting instruments, delicate stuff, so they couldn't put it in the truck. And they had a big long box full of long white stemmed plastic roses. And I asked the guys, I said, so what are these roses for? And they all looked at me, kind of like smiled. And I got to the first gig and we unloaded shit. And I was sort of off in the wings and I'm looking at the crowd, the audience at these concerts. I mean, I'm old. I'm listening to Fresh Cream tapes from 1970 or 69. I'm so out of music. I don't know anything except the energy. The crowd went insane. The women in the front row were insane. And after a while, this one guy, he sort of stopped and he took one big white stem rose and took it down and kind of threw it out to this one woman who clutched it between her breasts. And I realized afterwards that white rose was her ticket backstage after the show. So I was kind of like,
nope.
What happened, Billy?
I don't know, but it's a good way to freeze him.
Look
at him. He looks great there. He's got the halo. Oh, he's back.
Wait, are you back? Oh. Did you lose me?
Yeah, we lost
you. There, you're back.
It was like
you're
a back. Halo above your head with the gold.
did I even tell you the story about the white roses?
She gets to go backstage, but that was it. You were talking about how amazing she was, and then it's like.
All right.
How about the one when you took the bare naked ladies to Alcatraz?
Oh God, yes. They did it. I forgot that. They did a concert out on Alcatraz and I drove all the stuff up to the dock there and everybody went out to Alcatraz and the concert was, it ran late and the fog started to roll in and I was by myself on the docks as this fog kind of just enveloped everything. And when they finally finished the concert, the last of the ferries came back and I'm still there because I got to wait till the last of the equipment and shit comes back. And it was really strange and really bizarre. At one point I was in the van and this guy came walking out of the fog. One of those San Francisco characters. He had like a robe and he had hair and he had a beard and he had these eyes that looked like they were glowing. And he kind of like floated up next to me and stopped next to me and looked at me up in the van and I'm looking at him. And then he looked around at the fog and then out at the island and he gave me this grin like, yes, we're all here together. It's like, whoa, let me roll this window up, go away. But he was crazy. I loved it. Yeah.
They did invite him to go over to the island prison, but Billy declined that part, right?
I had actually been there once. I went out myself previously a few years earlier and I realized I don't want to go out there again. Because it's got vibes. It's got stuff going on. Oh my God. It's got stuff. In fact, sure I wanted to go out and get locked in and spend my night all by myself out on the island somewhere and then like kind of write a story about it, but I chickened out. I'm not going out there.
Is there any part of of the movie that you would say was crafted better than the book? Anything.
Crafted better than the book. Well, you're talking to the author, so yeah, that's a hard question.
Yeah.
But the truth is, they did a really good job. They had a certain sensibility about the visuals about it that worked really well. And I think the music, I think Giorgio's music was so evocative that I literally now, I met Chris Bennett, the lady who did that song, you know, the nocturne where, you know, da 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 da. So she told me that she was working, doing disco stuff with Giorgio. And Giorgio called her up one night and he said, Chris, I have this job and it's a movie and it's a Midnight Express. I don't know what, I haven't read the book, but something about he escapes. And so she said, wait, stop. He said, so I need you to write music. You're home and I need it in I think 6 days. Because Giorgio came in, played Alan Parker, a little bit of the doodah, and he had that new synthesizer thing that was sort of a new sound. And Alan Parker, Giorgio saying, he listened, he said, okay, do it. And he didn't see me again because he was so busy. So I was free. And he said, because I'd never done this before, I didn't have the restrictions that people do. I didn't know what was good or bad or right or wrong. I just played what I wanted. And the movie so moved me that the music came out of the movie. And he said, he told Chris, write a song about this guy. And she was home and she said, what is this? This is someone I love. He's in a foreign country and I may never see him again. How do I feel about that? And she said, pretty much in an hour or two, the words came to her and the music came to her. And she said, I'm doing it now. I'm so emotional. She said she was in tears, which is what I usually, if I write something good, if I'm not crying or aching, it's not good. I know that. I need to put more into it. She said, when I'm crying, my music is there. And I loved that music. To this day, I didn't get to meet Chris for years and years for some reason. I met everybody else and I never met her. And then I finally got to meet her at this gathering and she sat me down at the piano next to her and she played that song for this crowd. And I was like bawling. I mean, I'd literally get on my handkerchief. It just knocks me out. And I think that music, all of it was really good. And I think people remember, you can play then, you know, a couple of little bits. And they all know it. They know where it came from.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think the music did an amazing thing with the movie.
Yeah.
And Brad Davis gave his heart and soul to this thing too. He was, you know, he gave his everything to the film.
Yeah. You know, you and I have been talking a lot lately, but that's because I'm a lucky guy. I was going to make a joke or whatever, but I can't even joke. I really love talking. That's why I've been calling you all the time. But
good. Yeah, no, I like talking.
Good. Oh.
Gotta hold my book up. If I'm talking, I got to promote my book. This is the new one. This is the book that essentially I wrote during COVID. You know, I'm always making notes and keeping notes and I'm going to write, but I keep putting it off. And then I was doing a one-man show for about 7 years around the world on and off. I mean, COVID stopped that, of course. So it sort of forced me. I sat down and for COVID period, I wrote the book, which was good, kept me busy, kept Wendy safe. Like,
what is the nuttiest questions you've been asked after the one-man show? Do you do an open question thing after?
Yeah, I don't even leave the stage. I, you know, finish it, say thank you, and they clap a little bit. And then I say, and you know, who's the brave soul who wants to ask the first question? And it usually takes a moment or two. And somebody will raise their hand, you know, what's it feel like? Or doing blah, blah, blah. And then they talk about the differences between the book and the film. But, you know, my show helps explain a lot of that. It's 73 minutes. And it's essentially, it's me on a stool with a microphone, just talking. And then the Q&A, I like that as much as the show because It in the beginning of the run, it kind of informed me and the director, Jeffrey Altshuler, what people ask questions. It's like in my mind, I'm thinking, I actually answered that in the show, but they didn't get it. Or I didn't say it in a way that it connected. So
that would be me. I'd be like, so you were in South America?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Coconuts. I floated off the island in a bale of coconuts. Oh, no, that's Papa John. That's right.
The Kentucky Expedition and Billy Hayes.
Yeah. But it was good because I could tighten the show up. It's a little dangerous taking advice from the audience and people, but it was very good for us and to tighten the show up a lot. And I loved hearing what people had to say afterwards. And the thing, my biggest hesitation for doing the show was for years, I didn't want to do this. I kept saying, you know, people are sick to death, all this Billy Hayes Midnight Express bullshit. I am. So how can anybody else stand hearing it? And my friends kept saying, you know, we get you to a party and they get you all stoned and then you're telling these stories anyway. Why don't you put it in a theatrical piece? So I didn't want to do it. And then I started to write it and I realized, holy, I needed to get this out. This is like sort of a culmination. And it was the chance for me to be all I am and to say and to offer whatever I could at this stage of my life. So it was a couple of years of working and writing and changing. And then I met a producer in LA, a lady who I'd known for a while named Barbara Ligeti. And she read the script, loved the script. And it was her focus and her dedication that forced me to finish it and take us where we are now, which is on the road. We went to Edinburgh. The first time I was there, it was the last three nights of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And I did three shows. And from that, we never stopped doing the show around the world, in Australia, mm-hmm. Lebanon, and New York, and all kinds of London, Edinburgh, yeah.
Cool. So Train Keeps Rolling is mostly about the stage show and everything that went around it, or?
It's actually, my first book was Coming Home. The second book was like 10 years later, Midnight Return, sort of the follow-up and what happened next. Then I didn't do anything for 10 years, but I put a book of letters out. The letters I mentioned that I wrote home that people kept, I kept them all. I had them in a box up in the attic, and I was throwing them out at one point when Wendy, my wife, made me come back and bring them back in. And I mentioned, I hate doing this, I had mentioned to my lawyer, who was also my friend, that I got this box of moldy old letters. He said, what letters? I said, oh, these yellow moldy letters from jail. He said, let me read a few, which he did. He said, you need to take all these letters, organize them and compose them, and do not change a single word. And therein lies the rub, to read what you think about life at 22 and 23. Oh my, who is this idiot writing these things? But it was very informative. And the letters had a real arc to them in terms of who this guy, this idiot kid, and the change that happened over 5 years. Very interesting. My wife's favorite book. She edits and composes and produces my books now. Everything is, you know, self-produced. E.P. Dutton was nice because they set everything up. Had the buses, had the plane, had the people coming in, taking my luggage, and I talk wherever they want, but they took all the money. Now you do it yourself, but you have to promote it yourself, which is why we so love the blogs that all you guys are doing out here these days. And it's one-on-one with the audience that hopefully you'll be talking to and selling books to and that kind of stuff.
So, yeah, I love it that it's easy to get a hold of people these days, you know?
Yeah.
It's not that hard if you really want. There's Twitters and then the Facebook and everything, and a lot of times you can just shoot them a message and the guy will be like, yeah, what do you want?
Yeah, I got dragged kicking and screaming onto Facebook. I didn't want to do it. I didn't need, you know, I'd done all that stuff. It was too crazy. I wanted to get back and away from it. But I realized I had to be there because it was the media, and this is 10, 15, whatever years ago. And now I love it because I get to see folks and I see people I hadn't seen forever. And I see the photos of the kids growing up and all that good, funny stuff. But no, this dog don't tweet. I can't get that connected to the world of having this Twitter shit going on. And I had Instagram. They gave me a Twitter feed. It was Billy Hayes hash, but I've never used it. I never put it in. And Instagram is the same. I posted like a couple of pictures. Again, I can't handle it. I can barely open emails. As you see,
a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And technically, I'm so bad at it, it frustrates the shit out of me.
Takes out of yoga time. It's not good.
Exactly. I'm doing my yoga an hour in the morning. I'm chill for the rest of the day. I don't need to be online arguing with people anymore. When you used to come in. Go ahead.
Do you have any questions that you remember people asking you that made you laugh after the shows or just in general?
What did you eat in jail? You know, what kind of sex did you have? I said, that's the first question you ask. You're interested in that. He said, well, yeah. I said, well, you know, most people are. And I talk about that. I say, is there anything else you want to know? He'd hesitate. And then some woman across the room would say, well, what's the first sex you had on the outside? And I'd have to talk about that.
It's a psychiatry session.
I love it. It was just fine. And once the audience gets into it, it's fun. And you can just have so much fun. But people, again, the thing that moved me about doing the show that I realized is, again, I kept thinking nobody wants to hear this. Afterwards, I realized people kind of said the same thing in a lot of ways, which is that they found the show inspirational, which as an actor, that's the highest tribute I can have, because I'd love that, because they all said, you know what, everybody could relate, because people have all been there, you know, but everybody's been down in a deep hole somewhere struggling to get out. My story is a little bit more compact and dramatic, and you could put it between 1970 and 1975, but everybody else has been there. And they said, you know, you've been down there and you struggled through and it looked like you were going to get out and then you didn't and then you were going to make it and then you made it out. So it was a catharsis for me, obviously, every night when I tell the show, it's cathartic. But the audience also gets the relief. They escape in their own lives or they conquer whatever it is that they're having to deal with. And I love hearing that. And I think that's why the show resonates and why I've been doing it for so long.
I want to take you to an escape room.
You know, I've seen these.
I think we would win. Really, we would do great.
I think you got to be kidding me. Come on, man.
Oh, we would do so good. Come on. We'd be out of that place in minutes.
Yeah. Listen, escape room, if there's nobody beating your feet with a stick, it's not an escape room. People ask me, how did you get through pandemic? People said it must have been really tough for you to be locked down for a pandemic. It's like, no, locked down. You can go out and go to the store. Locked up, that's different than locked down. You don't go out when you're locked up. So I was kind of enjoying the pandemic because, again, I feel for the world and for the people who died, and I had, unfortunately, friends who did. But I like the isolation. I like the quiet. I like the streets not being buzzed. The air here in Vegas was, it's pretty clear anyway, but got so clear.
Yeah.
So I kind of enjoyed that part of it. And I was writing every day, which was always good for me to be working.
Sure. What do you think about this Brittany Griner lady? Is she fucked? Is she going to get out? Or what did you think of Rodman going to save her?
I don't know if you've seen it, but I've been doing some interviews on a couple of these TV talking head shows about her. This one woman, I'll remember her name somewhere, but she's had me on twice now. Like one morning right after it happened, I think that she called me at 9 a.m. and 11, I was on the air on the TV talking about it. People wanted to know, you know, what would you think? And so I kind of gave them my opinion.
Was it hard to find a time or you had 2 hours?
No, I was here in my t-shirt. I actually put a t-shirt. I had a strapless on. It was so hot. My wife wanted me to clean up. So I put the t-shirt on for you.
She's a good manager, this one.
Yes, she
keep
is.
Her around.
I'm working on it. I always say that I love having smart women telling me what to do. Makes my life so easy. And I have a smart woman here. So that's good. But yeah. Brittany, I feel bad for my. What I said to them is, I think if she looked in the videos that I could see, she looked calm. She didn't look like she was panicking, and she didn't look beat or abused. Again, this is a 6'9" basketball star, an Olympic player. First of all, I don't think anybody's going to mess with her. Secondly, the fact that she's had a discipline in terms of her life as a basketball player, that discipline needs to be transferred now, maybe internally, in terms of keeping herself calm. In jail, you have no control over anything except yourself. And I advised, try yoga. You know, if she hasn't tried it, I'm sure she's got something similar. She's an athlete. She's got her own ways of dealing with it. And you need to have your body work to keep your emotions calm, to keep your brain calm. Because if you're not calm, you're making a mistake somewhere. And mistakes are magnified in jail. And I think she's calm. I think she's got it together enough. I mean, she's been in there for 5 months. That's a long fucking time. I was in for 5 years. I can't even imagine that. But I know what 5 months is. It's enough to realize, holy shit, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know how long I can keep doing this. And I'm sure she's at that point. And now, unfortunately, Dennis Rodman, I hope his intentions are good, but he was going to go over there and try and help her. That's not good for her. The raising her profile, keeping her in the news, having these news shows on and having the world aware of it, I think might be helpful. But behind this, Bill Richardson, a negotiator, he's brilliant. He's behind the scene trying to negotiate a deal to bring her and some other Americans home, etc. But having Dennis Rodman doing all this publicity and saying, you know, he brought somebody home from North Korea and he's friends with Kim Jong-un, and that's not good. And he's not going to work Vladimir Putin the way he worked the basketball fanatic Kim Jong-un. And that I know, and I don't think it's good for Brittany Griner. But I hope, all I can do is hope that somewhere they'll realize, you know, they're going to get bad publicity on this. But, you know, Ukraine's happening, and they don't seem to care about that.
The stuff I was seeing was her anti-flag rhetoric before she was in Russia. But I'm kind of like, well, the punishment fitting the crime is a little excessive.
Yeah, exactly. You know? All kinds of people are complaining about the fact that, well, she was dissing her country. I think what she was doing is protesting, taking a knee, which that's a diss that costs, what's his name, his career for taking a knee, for talking out. And If you can't talk out about the truth, which is what she's talking about, I think, and those on the other side who say, well, she got what she deserved for talking bad about her, I'm with you. How about the punishment fitting the crime?
Yeah, I think 5 months is pretty.
Yeah, and she's not out yet, and she's got a 9-year sentence. And you know what? This could. I hope. I don't even want to say the words, but this has to end soon and end well. I hope, or I think it could go on for a long time. And yeah. I wish her the best.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I do appreciate your time. If you have any other stories, Brian, if you have any rock and roll stories, since we talked a lot of prison talk this time, I don't know.
Sorry about that.
Sort of prison-like, right? It depends who you're on tour with. I don't know.
Most of the work I do now, I have to sign NDAs for, so I can't tell you about them.
Oh, so this is perfect.
Yeah, so
this
yeah,
was a great interview. This is the best one you've had. You're all excited.
Yeah, right. So no, I do stuff, you know, in Beverly Hills and Bel Air and Malibu and a lot of high profile celebrity type of things. But
so you're moving their equipment, like they have the recording studio.
No,
so they'll move whatever.
I'm an audio guy as well. I think I told you earlier I became a sound guy, and so typically I'm working audio for their private events at their houses and
you know,
in their living rooms and backyards and all kinds of things like this.
Whatever pays the bills, huh?
Yeah, like, and they pay me pretty well, and it's kind of fun. It's a little surreal, you know, like I can tell you what I did a little bit. I did a couple of Christmas parties at the Kardashian house and it's literally like living in a reality TV show because it's all those people that you see in those shows are there at their house and that's what we're doing, you know? And
what's the band that you enjoyed working for most all the years?
Band I enjoyed working most?
Like a band that you were a big fan of and then you were like, other than Kiss, maybe it is.
I wasn't a fan of Kiss, unfortunately, before I worked for them. I actually became a fan after working for them because I learned to appreciate them.
It makes it you appreciate so much more because you're like, I like you guys.
I learned to like them. There's a little difficulty along the way, but actually a band that I love and I still work with is a band called ABC. They're out of London. They had some hits back in the 80s, Look of Love and Shoot That Poison Arrow and a few other things that, you know, were on the charts. They were huge in Europe. They managed to chart in America a few times, and they come back annually. And Martin Fry, who's the singer, leader of the band, he and I have become good friends. And so it's just enjoyable when he calls up, hey, we're going to come do a little American tour. Because I really don't like touring anymore. I'm kind of over living on a bus. I'm kind of over, you know, just being on the road. I've got a great home. I've got a great wife. And, you know, I love Los Angeles. I've been here for 20 plus years now.
Oh, wow.
But you know, once in a while it's fun to go out and work with real professionals, and they're a great group of guys. The musicians are incredible, some of the best musicians out there, and they bring it. It's not like just some retro band like living off their name. It's actually, yeah, like I said, their name wasn't huge in America as it was. Their songs were bigger than their name.
Yeah.
And but when they do a show, it's
because the name's so complicated.
It must be what it is.
I think it was it. Yeah.
But anyway.
I could tell you who I like to work with the best.
We got
Brian called me up, and I ended up doing, I think it was around Christmas time, with the van up somewhere in the snow in Vail or Colorado. It was Chris Isaak.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah.
First of all, I loved his music, but as an actor and I direct a lot of theater too, I like to watch the interaction that the performers on stage have with the audience and such. And I never saw anyone so good as Chris Isaak. He's so genuine. His audience back and forth, his repartee, his patter, but it's the truth of what he does when he sings gets people so caught up and so emotional. He was my favorite. I listened to him every night that he played. I basically sat back and listened. I don't always do that. You know, sometimes I'd let the West Side Connection go on their own because I couldn't handle it. It was so annoying. And the energy knocked me off my feet. But Chris Isaak, God, he was so good.
Is it Forever Blue? Isn't that one of his albums?
Yeah, Brian will tell you. All I know
is the Something Blue, that album is, it's just song for song. It's perfect.
Yeah, he's so good. His voice is just amazing.
That's what we should do. We should get Oliver Stone, you, and Georgia Moroder to do a stage play about Chris Isaak.
Yeah, right.
And maybe the Kardashians. Let's just bring it all together.
Bring them all in there, yeah.
Giorgio's bored these days. He's working on another car. All right, I don't know. Now I'm going to get in trouble. I don't even know what the hell I'm talking about. But guys, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. You're putting this together, and you're going to edit it a little bit, and then you'll let us know when it's going to air.
I'll
edit
out all the parts where you talk.
Clean it up. Good.
I'll talk to you guys soon.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
BA. Thanks, Brian. See you, buddy.
Good seeing you, Billy.
Thanks for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe by clicking the round button on the bottom right. To learn more about me or the guests on the show, go to joelrode.com. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok. The handle's Joel Rode. And don't forget, when you party like a rock star, don't be a dick.